A Senate bill known as the Regulatory Accountability Act has backing from Republicans and at least two Democrats. It's designed to use better science, strengthen checks and balances, and give the public more of a voice in federal rulemaking. But my next guest says the bill has a glaring error. Richard Pierce Jr. is a law professor at George Washington University, and he joins me now in studio. Professor Pierce, good to have you on.
Thank you, Tom.
This bill does, well, first of all, let's review what the bill basically would do should it become law.
It would add a great many mandatory procedures to the process of issuance of rules through notice and comment. Agencies would have to take a lot more steps in order to issue a rule, and then it would instruct courts to be more demanding of agencies as they review those rules.
I guess this is maybe the first major update or proposed major update to rulemaking probably in 40 years.
If it were to be enacted, it would be, yes.
And we should say the senators behind it are Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, and Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat from North Dakota. But you found a flaw in it in Section 3E that has to do with the conducting of oral evidentiary hearings. Tell us about that.
Yes, it has a provision that says that whenever any major rule, economically significant rule, raises any issue of science or economics or any other complicated factual issue of that type, then the agency must conduct an oral evidentiary hearing before one of its administrative law judges before it can issue the rule.
And is that required now under any circumstances?
No. In fact, it was explicitly rejected in a series of three U.S. Supreme Court opinions issued in 1971, 1972, and 1978 as totally unnecessary and creating nigh interminable hearings.
What did the court mean by that? What was the genesis of the court saying, stop these hearings?
By the time that those cases were decided, we had a lot of experience with attempts to use oral evidentiary hearings in the context of rulemakings, the most famous of which was the peanut butter case, where the Food and Drug Administration spent over 8 years in oral evidentiary hearings to try to decide whether peanut butter must contain 87% peanut products or 90% peanut products. It was about halfway through the proceeding when the FDA gave up. The Supreme Court, by the time it issued that trilogy of opinions in the 1970s, had a lot of experience with cases like this and had, in four prior opinions, characterized the results as the creation of nigh interminable hearings.
So hearings that never ended, in other words.
Yes.
So that's what gave rise to the current system where people submit written documentation, written evidence, and so forth that gets entered into the Federal Register and then is reviewed by the agency?
Exactly. The way it works now is that any interested member of the public, certainly included potentially affected regulated firms, can and do submit extensive comments. They run at least hundreds of thousands of pages, often millions of pages, in which they provide their views, they submit studies relevant to the issues, and then the agency looks with great care at those and issues a several hundred page statement of basis and purpose in which it explains why it has issued the rule it has, and it responds to every important, well-supported point that has been made in any of those comments.
Because the old oral hearings had cross-examinations, which is something also that would be required by this law, should it become law. And so that must make things longer, more complicated, and make it seem like the rule itself is on trial.
Yes, I have to say I had the misfortune of participating in a couple of those proceedings in the 1970s when I was in practice. My law firm loved it because they could just send me every day. I did absolutely nothing but sit there and wait for my turn, which would come up every 4 or 5 days. And, you know, the judge would say, okay, we're now going to question witness 17, lawyer 42. You're up to question witness 17. We only have 40 more witnesses to go. Those proceedings never ended.
We're speaking with Richard J. Pierce, Jr. He is a professor of law at George Washington University. If this were to come into law, then these hearings somehow would return, these oral hearings. But you're also making a distinction between the types of facts that come up in rulemaking. There are adjudicative facts and legislative facts. And how does that play into this?
Yes,
what are those, and how would they figure in?
It's quite rare for a rulemaking to address an issue of adjudicative fact. Adjudicative facts are the kinds of facts that are usually resolved in our legal system through use of oral testimony subject to cross-examination, and they involve questions like who, what, where, when, and why. And if, for instance, there's a barroom brawl and it produces civil or criminal proceedings, then we have to figure out who threw the first punch, why, when. Those kind of issues are appropriate for oral evidentiary hearings subject to cross-examination.
What would be an example, say, in rulemaking of adjudicative fact?
Oh, it's actually extremely rare for it to arise in a rulemaking. When an agency is confronted with a question like that, it's usually handled in an adjudication, which is dealt with by agencies and often in a manner similar to the way that courts address them. But it's very rare for any rulemaking to raise an issue of that type. They tend to raise issues only of legislative fact.
And what does legislative fact mean?
Legislative facts are really best described by in the language of the Senate under consideration version of the Regulatory Accountability Act. Their disputes with respect to scientific or economic facts or other highly technical facts, they are not appropriate for resolution through use of oral evidentiary hearings subject to cross-examination. They are the kinds of issues that are routinely resolved by people looking with great care at studies that may come to different conclusions, for instance, about how much exposure to some pollutant will cause public health problems, and hence, at what level we should limit the emissions of that pollutant from various industrial facilities.
Do you have any insight into why Congress would consider putting back in oral presentations like this?
Well, I respect certainly the senators who have proposed this, and I believe that they believe that this would improve the quality of the output of the rulemaking process. I think they're completely mistaken about that, and they're ill-informed on that subject.
You wonder if staff looked up what happened in the 1970s with respect to the Supreme Court and maybe said, hey, this was ruled not necessary by the Supreme Court a long time ago.
I don't know. I've been trying to call that to their attention. And we'll see whether that is effective. There is, there's the floor debate and floor consideration, if it ever gets to the floor, yet to come. And I'm optimistic that enough people will look at that history, look at the facts, and realize that it's a very bad idea and that it will not be enacted, at least in that form. But we'll see.
Nowadays, you don't really need to be present to testify because of the video technology that is available that was not available back then. Could there be some streamlined version of oral presentations or in-person, quote-unquote, presentations that would take advantage of some of these technologies but not get us into the nigh endless ones that the Supreme Court cited so long ago?
In the context of adjudication, some agencies have been using techniques of that type, at least on an experimental basis. So, for instance, in Social Security disability cases, often the administrative law judge takes testimony electronically. That would never work in a rulemaking. You're talking about a case in which typically there are thousands of affected parties and interested parties who want to participate, and that it's not possible with any technology to accomplish that except by... I did it once, renting the ballroom of a hotel, and even then I could only do it for a few days and got very far, very little into the proceeding before I gave up.
Richard Pierce Jr. is a law professor at George Washington University. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Tom.